Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, November 25th. The Federal Department of Education wants to remove nursing from a list of professional degrees. That means less federal money available for advanced degrees. This comes as the country faces a nursing shortage. We get reaction. We take a closer look at the battle brewing over Hawaii's green fee. The Trump administration is eyeing the lawsuit filed by the cruise industry. We also check the temperature of our oceans. Scientists have been monitoring marine heat waves. What does this mean for our coral reefs? And November is National Family Caregivers Month. We consider long-term care coverage, what caregivers need to know. Plus, did you know we have a native blueberry in Hawaii? We find out more. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The country is facing a nursing shortage, so some are questioning a move by the Federal Department of Education to no longer consider nursing as a professional degree. It's just one of eight programs, including teaching and architecture, that are no longer considered professional degrees. This move will effectively cut the federal money available to help grow our pool of nurses. This morning, we hear from two programs that produce not just nurses, but other healthcare workers that could be dropped from the professional degree list. First, we hear from Chaminade's nursing dean, Lauren Ramaki. The school has one of the largest nursing programs in the state, with undergraduate enrollment between 350 and 400 students. Currently, the program has 55 nurses seeking advanced degrees.
So here at Chaminade, we have four different tracks that prepare graduate-level nurses in different specialty areas, including psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, family nurse practitioner, pediatric nurse practitioner, and executive leadership. And each one of these tracks prepares our graduate nurses to take care of vital sectors of our community, with the majority of our graduates taking jobs here in Hawaii after they graduate to care for our community in a variety of capacities. We've seen enrollment of undergrad and our grad nursing programs at Chaminade have been growing due to community need and also the success of our students. And our students go out into the workforce as nurse practitioners in the graduate program, really to work in a wide range of healthcare settings. So this could include anything from primary care clinics, hospitals, specialty practices, urgent care centers, long-term care facilities, just to name a few. And they might also serve in mental health clinics, community health centers, doing telehealth services, a lot of different places that can help expand access to care for our community.
Wow, so you really do run deep.
Yeah.
And so when we hear this news about nursing being taken off the list as a professional degree, this means reduced opportunity to grow our pool of nurses here.
Correct. And I think it's really important to first understand what nursing graduates are, as they're primarily the ones that are affected by the current legislation. And I can also talk a little bit about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the potential impact that you were addressing. So we've really been following these changes here at Chaminade to really help best understand any impacts that there might be for our students, community, the nursing profession as a whole. As the American Association of College of Nursing, about 69% of post-baccalaureate students will utilize this type of federal funding. Graduate nursing programs provide advanced education for individuals who already hold a bachelor's degree and want to go on for advanced degrees. So these degrees prepare advanced practice nurses in critical roles to expanding healthcare, especially in underserved and rural communities, and they prepare at the master's and doctoral level. So again, in some of the fields that I talked about earlier, primary care, acute care, chronic care. And people may not realize that they also make up the nursing education workforce, which is really important, as graduate nursing degrees are required to teach in both the undergraduate and graduate nursing programs across the country. Recently, the Department of Education announced that it's moving forward with these changes that will have a direct impact on how graduate nursing students can borrow in federal loans. In 2025, in July, there were two things that happened. So one, we had the elimination of the Federal Direct Graduate Plus loans, and two, student loan caps that were put in place. So the Grad Plus loans were the loans that helped cover the gap between the federal aid that would cover any remaining tuition. And while we were expecting that those might be eliminated, the hope was, as you mentioned earlier, that nursing would be among the professions in the professional degree in the loan cap tier system. So in this new ruling, there were two tiers. So one, graduate programs in general were capped at $20,500 annually with a lifetime aggregate of $100,000. And then there was a second higher tier that we were hoping that nursing would be included in for professional programs, which had the higher limit of $50,000 and the annual lifetime limit of $200,000. And this is extremely important to us at Chaminade, but in nursing in general, because while the graduate nursing technically meets the definition of a professional degree program, it wasn't included in that ruling, so our students wouldn't be allowed to access those higher loan limits. So that's how it could really impact our, not only our university, but universities across the country and ultimately the workforce there.
And so what are you folks doing to push back on this notion that nursing should not be on this professional degree list?
Sure. So one of the things that happens next is in the coming months, there you'll really see a collaborative effort of nursing organizations, probably universities as well, and individuals advocating for their voices to be heard. That proposed ruling is expected to come sometime early in 2026, at which time a minimum of 30-day period will open up where comments from the public can come in. And so that's really where our voices can be heard. So up until that time, you'll see a lot of things in the public with different surveys or petitions or things like that nurses can get involved in if this is something that they care about to help share that collective voice, to help share with the public some of the unintended consequences that might come from the language.
And that was Lauren Romaki, Chaminade's nursing dean, who says healthcare in the rural areas could be among the areas most impacted. And this morning, we also checked in with Hawaii Pacific University. It has some 300 students enrolled in their graduate nursing program. But there are other healthcare positions that might be dropped from the list of professional degrees, including physician assistants and physical therapists. We spoke with HPU's Dean of Graduate Health Sciences College, Tricia Catalino. She's worried because the programs, as they are, aren't meeting the community's current need.
Our kuleana is to train the next generation of our healthcare workforce. And so if we see decreases, further decreases of students going into these programs, the downstream effects are care for communities and patients at all stages of their life. So from keiki to kupuna, right? These are people who go out and help folks live healthy, treat chronic conditions, and rehab from injury, diseases, surgeries, anything like that. So without these people in our healthcare system, we can guarantee that our population is going to get sicker, not be able to do the things they want to do the way they want to do them, if that makes sense. So yeah, deeply concerned about the shortages and continued shortages to our healthcare workforce.
And what areas are we talking about specifically under the health science program there at HPU?
So we train doctors of physical therapy, doctors of occupational therapy, and physician assistants. And the individuals in each of these roles are professionals and have autonomy in their practice. So they are working in schools, they're working in communities, hospitals, rehab centers, in every stage of the healthcare continuum alongside nurses and physicians, speech-language pathologists, social workers, psychologists, and so it's the entire healthcare team that is at risk here.
And talk about shortages that we have in these fields right now here in Hawaii.
Yeah, so right now we are not meeting our current needs. So there are open positions pretty much in every sector of healthcare in Hawaii, and oftentimes hospitals, clinics, et cetera, have to rely on short-term contracts or people traveling to our state to fill these needs, and often then not able to stay long-term. So you train folks, but they're not able to stay to continue care for patients and needs in all of these locations. So year over year, we have annual reports on our workforce shortage in healthcare, and all of these professions have notably had shortages across the board. So something like this will continue that or make it worse, to be honest.
We do have an aging population, and we're an island state, so it's not like people can just drive across state lines and get another job.
That's right. You're absolutely right. So we created programs at HPU with that in mind. So prior to starting these programs at HPU, We didn't have any programs for occupational therapy or physical therapy, and part of our mission is to be able to train folks to live and stay in the communities where they grew up and they live, to support the communities where they live. So that's the whole point. And so to your point, if we have a shortage and fewer people going into these professions, it just will perpetuate.
It seems short-sighted.
Yes, I agree.
And so what are you folks doing to push back on this, to make sure that these professions have a chance at some of this federal funding?
So each of our associations that are aligned with our professions, so for example, I myself am a physical therapist, and so my professional organization is the American Physical Therapy Association. And along with AOTA, which is the American Occupational Therapy Association, and PAEA, which is the Physician Assistant Education Association, all have advocacy efforts that are in place now. So members are receiving information. We have political action bulletins and ways that we can contact our representatives and senators to let them know how we're feeling about this, but also that we're prepared for public comment once that opens. So everyone is getting information now, sharing information now. There's a lot of conversation on social media, if you can imagine. Interviews like this are helpful to get the message out. And I think it's also important that our students, our prospective students, and even patients and families of patients also get this information. So it's about sharing it so they can add their voice as well, because this isn't just about our programs. It's about the health of communities.
Yeah, it's not just for the care of our kupuna, our loved ones, our grandparents, our parents, but pretty much ourselves, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I'm so glad you said that, because it's true. I'm like, who's going to take care of me when I need it?
Yes. All right. Thank you so much for your time this morning, just to underscore what we're dealing with.
Yes, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That was HPU's Tricia Catalina, Dean of Graduate Healthcare Sciences College. And before that, we heard from Chaminade's Dean of Nursing, Lauren Ramaki. Both expressed concern about reduced federal funding for healthcare professions where there are national shortages. We did also reach out to the Nurses Union. The Hawaii Nurses Association President, Rosalie Agassiu, released a statement saying in part that the administration should be making pathways to these fields easier and more affordable, because all Americans deserve fast access to quality health care from providers who are not overworked and exhausted.
Support for HPR comes from HSO's Hapa Holiday Extravaganza, featuring Natalie I. Kamau, Thursday, December 18th, with Tao Dance Theater and more at the Blaisdell Concert Hall. MyHSO.org.
Do your friends describe you as a wordsmith? Do you have a knack for digital media? HPR is looking for a communications and digital marketing manager to join our membership team. If you're a team player, able to work across departments, and are committed to HPR's mission to inform, inspire, and connect, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs and apply today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at alohaaircargo.com.
Hawaii's new green fee has caught the eye of the Trump administration. It's now asking to join a legal fight by the cruise industry, and that lawsuit seeks to block passengers from having to pay an additional fee, much like the hotel room tax, which is being used to offset the impact of the visitor industry on our communities. And here to talk about the pushback is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Marcel Henri. Good morning, Marcel.
Morning, Catherine. How's it going?
Good. So what were you able to find about this filing by the Justice Department?
Well, yeah, it's pretty interesting. This is a filing, a motion to intervene by the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, in a this is a case that is in federal court, and it's the cruise industry, Cruise Lines International, the association that is challenging the state and the county tax leviers on over the issue of the new green fee. The case was filed back in August, and then one day, I think it was like the evening before the first hearing in this lawsuit, the DOJ filed this motion to intervene.
Yeah, well, you know, we just had Jeff Michelina, the head of that council that, you know, is looking to dole out the money from the green fee. And yeah, I mean, these different organizations, you know, are hoping to tap into that fund. But, you know, I'm sure this is making people nervous.
Right. It leaves a lot in limbo. So Jeff and the rest of the Green Fee Advisory Council, which is going to make the recommendations to the governor and to lawmakers on which, you know, which projects should benefit from what is estimated to be about $100 million annually collected from this green fee. And in a briefing last week, Jeff said that they were looking at 620 potential applicants for projects that, you know, the total valuation on that is around $2 billion. So you can see there's a massive demand for these kind of projects that would both better protect the environment from over-tourism and things like that, as well as try and shore up the infrastructure around the state to better prepare for climate change and the growing effects of climate change. It's not exactly clear how much the cruise industry would represent, but it would be a slight difference. And so it's a little tricky for them to, you know, balance and weigh which projects to approve when you're not even 100% sure what your revenues are going to look like from this green fee.
Yeah, and do we know when the next go-around is, now that the Justice Department wants to push in on this?
Yeah, it's not clear. I was just checking the docket, and there's nothing new filed in terms of a new hearing date pursuant to that. There's been some filings, you know, little turns of the screw of who's going to represent the DOJ, but we're not sure. You know, it's interesting. I was speaking with somebody from the William Richardson School of Law's Environmental Law Program, Richard Walsgrove, last week, and he mentioned there are cases that are filed all the time that challenge the constitutionality of an issue, right, that people are suing over. But, you know, the DOJ does not jump into every single case around the country that is challenging that. It has to be very selective. So he's basically saying you have to ask the question, why are they jumping in on this? And, you know, it's coming at a time when the Trump administration is really challenging a lot of the climate change initiatives that are taking place both around the country and particularly here in Hawaii. You know, Trump has said that he believes climate change is a hoax. So it's kind of, this is all happening kind of with that broader atmosphere that's happening.
Yeah, but it's crazy. With so much at stake, this is going to have us on pins and needles.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I imagine that, with all the applicants that they've had for this money, that they want to, hit the ground running. But, you know, maybe they can dole out some of the money and then hold the cruise line, part of it at bay,
right,
until they figure this out.
Right. They think that's what they'll be able to do, is that at the very least, the money that's collected from the hotel rooms and other short-term stays across the islands, that will continue to proceed. The cruise industry is trying, they've filed a motion, they're trying to stop any money from being collected at all while this case is going on, but that hasn't been ruled on either. So there's just a lot of questions. There will be some money collected. It's just not clear how much at the same time as you're seeing this huge demand.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Homeless Civil Beat reporter Marcel Henre. Look for his story on the green fee at civilbeat.org. You know, this year we didn't hear much about coral bleaching in our neck of the woods due to warming seas. Today, HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote has been talking to scientists about that, and she joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I sure haven't seen much bleaching in my swims around the island.
Yeah, so we may not have seen it or felt it, but we did have a near miss this year with a major marine heat wave that emerged in the northern Pacific in the late spring. And these heat waves, again, may not be something that we feel onshore, but they can have devastating impacts on our underwater ecosystem, specifically coral reefs. And so I reached out to Rob Tonin with the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology to understand if this marine heat wave was of concern. And he told me that when it first cropped up, experts initially thought it might trigger a mass coral bleaching event.
Based on the bleaching predictions, people started to track this around July. And by August, people were very concerned, and we were starting to see in some areas already some paling and bleaching of corals in August. And people thought that this is very early. There's a huge temperature reserve in the northern Pacific. And if this continues and intensifies, this would be a terrible event for Hawaii.
So we dodged a bullet, but so explain to us again how this coral bleaching actually happens.
Yeah, this is one of those things that I thought I knew, and then as I started reporting, turns out I didn't fully understand. So as a refresher, corals are dependent on microscopic algae that live within corals' tissues. And these algae photosynthesize, which is what provides corals with energy. They don't have an independent way to make food. They're also what give corals their vibrant colors. So in turn, the corals themselves offer the algae protection and shelter. It's a really symbiotic relationship. But when corals get stressed due to something like a spike in temperature, Tonin says that relationship starts to break down and the corals expel that algae.
And so what we have is a phenomenon called coral bleaching, where the corals are kicking out their symbionts and paling. They look white. As a result, they are not producing their own food anymore. So that basically sets a countdown to starvation. And things like the marine heat waves, where the temperatures get very high for an extended period of time, that starvation leads to large-scale death across our coral reefs.
Wow, starving. Wow, I just never made that connection.
Yeah, so the question I had was, if we did see these high temperatures, these increase in temperatures because of this marine heat wave, why weren't we getting coral bleaching? And this was another part of coral bleaching that kind of went beyond my initial understanding. We had elevated temperatures, but Tonin says that on its own may not be enough to cause mass bleaching.
That is one of the challenges that we think about when we talk about marine heat waves. Their impacts on coral reefs are not strictly the relation of temperature. It's a combination of things that cause coral bleaching. Temperature is certainly one of them, but light intensity and nutrients also change the way that corals are reacting to high temperatures. And so we need the combination of high temperature, low cloud cover with lots of light, sort of impacting the corals before they actually bleach and start to suffer from that.
Wow, so the clouds helped us.
Yeah, in this case, we were spared thanks to a lot of cloud cover and stormy weather, and temperatures have started coming down. So he and his colleagues are now anticipating that if there are impacts to our reef, they'll be minor and concentrated kind of in the northwestern Hawaiian chain. But this latest heat wave is one in a series that have threatened Hawaii's marine ecosystems, and marine heat waves are occurring with more frequency. So we're going to have to wait to see how long this respite lasts. And when they do occur, impacts are really long-lasting. So listeners might remember it was just about a decade ago in 2014, 2015, when a major marine heat wave hit Hawaii, and it absolutely cooked our reefs. This is what the heat wave that's commonly known as the blob, because that's what it looked like on ocean temperature charts. And that was the first time that we had a bleaching event that impacted the entire archipelago, but Hawaii Island was especially hard hit. One researcher I spoke with told me that certain reef systems along that west side of Hawaii Island, they lost up to 50% of their coral reefs during that event.
Wow. So how are those systems doing now?
I talked with Amy Olson. She grew up on Hawaii Island, and she's now a research scientist at the Seattle Aquarium, of all places. And she's part of this team that's been doing these yearly surveys of reef health and fish populations along 8 different sites on the west side of Hawaii Island. They've been doing that since 2019, or since 2009. So they have this really long data set for those reef systems. And they've been able to document the long-term effects of that heat wave in really great detail.
So we have a couple of sites that are, if you're familiar with the coast, in Mahukona. We have 3 sites in Puako, 2 sites off of Old Kona Airport, and then 1 site further south, just south of Kealakekua Bay. And in some of these areas, the coral had just been impacted so negatively that we're seeing slight increases, but not what we would term a recovery yet. That remains to be seen as we continue to monitor the areas and as climate continues to change. Other areas have had some recovery of certain species. So some of the more resilient coral species like Parietes lobata, which is like the very common kind of, we call it like a mounding or lobe coral, has been able to recover. But some of the other species that are called Passalapra, which are kind of more finger-like, have had a harder time recovering at our sites. And I think it's because they just have more of a surface area that can be impacted by warmer water temperatures and by physical action like waves and stuff. In one of our sites, we have seen corals bleach and then die over the years. But now there's new corals that are starting to repopulate on top of the dead coral species, a different species of coral. So it's very complicated and we're going to continue to monitor it, but it's kind of a mixed result in how the corals are doing now after that big hit in 2014.
Well, you know, I think both you and I have done some stories about how, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So how does that work? Does it just vary from species to species?
Yeah, to a degree. So when a coral bleaches, the coral isn't dead. It can recover. And if the stressors are reduced, then what happens is the coral might retake new algae and reestablish that relationship. But with really long things like marine heat waves, it's harder for corals to basically withstand that period of stressors. So when I posed that question to Rob Tonin, what can we do to help our coral reefs prepare for the next marine heat wave? He says, what we can focus on really is ensuring that our reefs are in the best condition possible before we get one of these oceanic heat waves. And that means reducing different forms of pollution that impact coral, so shoreline cesspools or runoff, to make sure that they're as resilient as possible. It also involves getting organizations and nonprofits together who are looking at coral restoration. So how can we identify those species that are a little bit more robust and make sure that those are the basis for our reefs?
Yeah, super interesting, but thanks so much. I learned a lot.
Thanks, Catherine.
And that was HPR's Savannah Harriman Poe. Look for her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. Aging is a reality we all face, and most people will need some form of long-term care during their lifetime. Planning ahead and purchasing long-term care insurance is one way to help cover the financial burden when the need for care arises. Tanya Fernandez is CEO of Ho'okele Home Care, one of the state's largest licensed home care agencies serving families on Oahu and Maui. She sat down with the Conversation's Lillian Song to highlight some common challenges. Fernandez warns, as a family caregiver, don't get hit by hidden costs and waiting periods. Be savvy about actions to take before triggering the policy.
So much of Hawaii and the culture of Hawaii is family takes care of family. And so kind of that whole notion of it takes a village, it does. It takes a village to care for an individual. And we, a home care agency, or even volunteer caregivers, can be one component of an overall bigger care plan for people. I think that's many of the situations that we encounter where normally we're getting calls from maybe son or daughter that says, I'm tired. I am working. I'm taking care of kids. I'm taking care of my parents. And I'm tired and I don't know what to do and I don't know where to turn. So many of our callers are individuals who have stories just like that. We can help ease that challenge, basically. You know, we have times where we're coming in and we might be just assisting a senior with a bath, for example. There are many times where the children are happy to come and take care of mom or dad, but things that are kind of more intimate, you know, more personal, like giving a bath or maybe doing a continence change, that may be challenging.
We need that professional person who does this, who's capable and probably very efficient.
Yes. And not only that, sometimes it just allows the family to become family members, right? And then concentrate on those interactions instead.
Right. And as I was preparing for today's conversation, it really surprised me. It's something that I'm not thinking about, which is long-term care insurance. Mm-hmm. And the fact that people should start thinking about this in their 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. Explain to me, what is long-term care insurance?
Sure. So long-term care insurance is really it's insurance designed to help people pay for care expenses. So it benefits individuals who can't independently perform certain everyday tasks, such as maybe bathing, grooming, you know, just getting dressed, or even feeding themselves. So it provides benefits so that you can use other organizations, you know, whether it be a home care agency or a nursing facility or assisted living, so that those organizations can provide help with those kinds of tasks. So long-term care insurance provides reimbursement for those kinds of services.
Okay. In your capacity at Ho'okele, you've seen some hidden challenges.
Yes.
When people think, I have long-term care insurance.
Right.
Mom and dad need it. They bought it. Mm-hmm. Let's utilize it.
Yes. So one of the biggest challenges, and I think sometimes misunderstandings that people have, is with regard to what's called an elimination period. Basically, the amount of time that you have to pay out of pocket for your costs before your benefits actually kick in. Unfortunately, people don't all understand that. And it can present a problem because if you're not aware of this elimination period, you could face a bunch of unexpected costs. We see elimination periods anywhere from 30, 60, 90, even up to 180 days. So when we're looking at, let's say, for example, nursing homes can cost individuals anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 a month now. Mm. So when someone triggers their policy, if they have a 90-day elimination period, now they're looking at 3 months of out-of-pocket costs.
It's like $45,000?
Exactly, before their reimbursement actually starts to kick in. So it could be a hidden cost if you don't understand what your elimination period is.
Okay. Any other things to be aware of?
Yes. Another thing that we also see is inflation. As you pointed out, individuals are typically purchasing or looking at long-term care insurance somewhere, you know, in their 50s and 60s. And so when that's the situation, many times they're maybe 20 years that they're waiting until they actually start to trigger the benefit. Mm-hmm. Say, you know, I'm buying a policy that gives me a $500 benefit today. And 20 years from now, $500 is going to be something very different than what it means to us today. So it's also being aware of inflation. And there are policies out there that have inflation protection so that your benefit can increase over time with inflation.
Anything else for our listeners to think about?
Another thing, just actually with regard to the elimination period that I also think is really important that can often get overlooked is the difference between calendar days and service days. I know there's so many details, but we've had situations where a client will start with us And we'll start with maybe getting one bath a week, just to kind of just get the process going, right? Get mom or dad used to having a caregiver come in. And so we may come in just once a week. And if someone has a 30-day elimination period, if it's based on calendar days, then after 1 month, their benefits start to kick in. However, there are policies where the elimination period actually is based on service days.
Like an accrued 30 days?
Yes, 30 service days instead. So,
oh, that is such a big difference.
It's an enormous difference. So now that 1 month, if we're coming in only once a week, could now be 7 months before the benefit actually kicks in. So again, exactly what you said, it's all about the details.
Wow. Okay. Good to know, though. When you're purchasing your policy, know that there are these differences.
Yes.
I'm learning so much, taking notes here, Tanya. Wow. Anything else to be mindful of?
I think the other thing that we have come across, and this is really important, again, because individuals are paying into these policies for 20 years, you know, premiums are going to increase. Or for that period of time, you could see premiums go up 50%, 100%. And it's really, really sad when we hear of situations where someone says, you know, my premiums were going up so much that I could no longer afford to pay for them. So they stopped paying for their premiums, which means that their long-term care benefits were now stopped and canceled.
Right.
And it's so unfortunate to hear that because, you know, many of these individuals were paying thousands of dollars to be able to have this basically plan for the future.
Yes.
It breaks my heart when I hear instances like that. And if anyone's ever in that situation, I would say have a conversation, right? Have a conversation with your agent or your financial planner, because there are things that they can do. You know, it might mean keeping premiums the same, but maybe benefits may come down or there's some kind of arrangement. And I think there should always be a conversation first, because it would be so unfortunate and really heartbreaking for these individuals to just stop and then now not have that benefit when they need it.
So have that conversation before the cancellation, because there might be things that you guys can work out. That's that investment of years of money that's already there in your name.
Yes.
So don't let it go.
Yes. There are things that can be done.
November is Family Caregivers Month, and you work a lot with caregivers. Are there tips that you would like to share for those family caregivers?
Yes, I think one of the biggest tips that we do is one, plan for care. I think that, you know, a lot of us know that we plan for a retirement, right? So we do the financial planning a lot of times, knowing that at some point in time, right, 65, 67, we need to have a plan for our financial future. And care plan or caregiving is also an enormous, enormous situation that we also have to plan for. So I think the biggest thing is to make a plan and to sit down with family or trusted advisors and really have those conversations. Those conversations can be difficult, but it's so important that we have them. Again, we're so fortunate to live in a community where there are resources and a lot of individuals who are willing to help. And it's important that we understand all of that ahead of time, so that when we're in that situation where the care need arises, whether it's aging or a sudden onset of an illness or something like that, we don't want to enter crisis mode. That's super unfortunate. And at that time, we're trying to figure out, what are we going to do now? Who's going to do what? Is mom going to be okay? Is brother going to take care? And we don't want to enter crisis mode. So what we want to do is have a plan, talk about it, start to gather information on different resources, and also make sure that the family knows what that plan is, so that when the situation arises, now we're implementing. And family can be really what they want to be, right? They want to be family. They want to take care. They don't want to be running around at that point figuring out what to do. It's really have a plan and then communicate that plan.
Tanya, thank you very much. And before I let you go, any final thoughts, anything that we wanted to cover that we haven't hit yet?
So the only other thing I would say is that there are a lot of resources out there. We're one of them. And there are a lot of organizations that help, whether it be through the Office on Aging or Veterans, VA, as well as various Medicaid programs too. But there are a lot of organizations out there. And I just say, reach out and get information. There's a lot out there. Hawaii is a fantastic community that really prides themselves on taking care of people. So reach out because resources are there.
That was Ho'okele Home Care CEO Tanya Fernandez and HBR's Lillian Song. Fernandez was talking about common challenges that family members face when using long-term care insurance. She suggests reading the fine print to avoid the financial and emotional strain when the time comes to transition a loved one into nursing care or home care.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Are you passionate about local journalism? Skilled at identifying a range of voices and perspectives? HPR is hiring a full-time producer to work on The Conversation, our flagship daily news and talk show. Read the full job description and apply at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Indie folk and soul singer-songwriter Joshua Radin performs songs such as I'd Rather Be With You, November 30th. Tickets at bluenotehawaii.com.
You may know that Hawaii and Japan have a slew of sister cities. Honolulu is siblings with Hiroshima and Shibuya, while Hawaii County has seven sister cities in Japan. Now researchers think that our native blueberry, known as ohelo, has a sister species in the mountains of Japan. Peter Fritsch is the Vice President for Research and Conservation at the Botanical Research Institute of Texas. He led a new study into the origins of the ohelo berry. Fritsch spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the research and the amazing world of blueberries.
I just found that these blueberries are just incredible. All the places that they can grow, all the habitats that they're growing in, and Hawaii just, it's really incredible that they even grow there, number one, and number two, that they're doing very well there.
What did we know about the origins of these blueberries in Hawaii and Polynesia?
Sure. There was an early study in the early 2000s that gave a pretty good inkling of what the origins might be within the blueberries themselves. So we had a pretty good idea that it was in one group of blueberries called the bilberries. And so those are primarily Western North America, but they also occur in Eurasia and also get down into the Neotropics. But the study was kind of hindered in a way by the fact that at the time, the type of data that one could get, it was great at the time. It was called Sanger DNA sequences, and it provided a level of insight, but couldn't really pinpoint the timing or the origin of groups the way we can do now with our more powerful types of data that we have at our disposal today. The data set that we have is about 100 times as large as the set that they had available to them in the early 2000s. So we've been able to really crank up the data. The computing power, of course, very important. Also, there's more known even about the flora of Hawaii than there was even back then. So that all those things together kind of helped us along in addressing this question.
And so when you looked at all these blueberries, all the sequences of these blueberries, what were you expecting to find in terms of where they originated from?
Well, we weren't entirely sure. I should say and step back that the blueberry group is a huge group of plants. It's about 1,400 species. So that also includes like the cranberry, for example. So not all blueberries are blue, and Ohio is mostly red berries, although there are a couple of blue ones as well. So we didn't really know if we could really, with the powerful data we had, be able to ultimately pinpoint it. We suspected it was somewhere around the Pacific Rim. That's where most Hawaiian and lineages originate from, either the mainland or, you know, the islands of the South Pacific, places like that. And so we suspected it to be somewhere in those areas. But other than that, it was kind of open-ended.
Yeah. And what you did find was actually, you write in the paper, it's quite rare among the native plants of Hawaii.
Yeah, the origin was determined to be or estimated to be northeastern Asia. The studies that have come out on Hawaiian plants, it's only about 4% came from that area. So that was a bit of a surprise. The nice thing about the story is, though, that, well, we use something called phylogenetic analysis, and that builds trees of genetic relatedness. And so that's what all this molecular data is doing. It's building this big phylogenetic tree. And so we have the relationships, somewhat like a genealogy that you might be used to, but strictly diverging branches going from the bottom to the top. Okay, so given that, what we were looking for was the sister group, the group that's the closest relative of the Hawaiian blueberries. And that's how we kind of determined that it was from the area of Northeast Eurasia. We're saying that the actual closest relative turned out to be a Japanese species, the technical name Vaccinium yatabii, without really a common name, and very rare in Japan, and it occurs in the mountains of Japan. But the nice thing is it has a red berry, unlike most of the other parts of the tribe, which have these blueberries. And so at least in that respect, if you had to predict what the sister, you know, species would be, the closest relative, it'd be something with a red berry. And so that kind of corroborated our findings.
And there is something very serendipitous about this berry winding up in Hawaii, where it grows so well, when its sister in Japan is quite rare.
It found the right place at the right time and was able to thrive.
Any idea as to how that berry could have traveled, like whether it would have been wind, wave, or wing?
Great question. Well, since it's a berry, you might expect not wind necessarily, because they wouldn't be able to float very easily. They're pretty large berries. It's probably bird. Most likely it's in the gut of a bird. It turns out that there are pretty extensive flyways from the northern parts of the globe in the Pacific to the Hawaiian area and even farther south from there. And so it's most likely probably was bird dispersed, like a lot of other fleshy fruited things that found their way to Hawaii.
Do you have outstanding questions about these blueberries since this paper got published, or is this kind of like the end of like, okay, we know where it's from and how it got here?
Great segue. Answers to questions always lead to more questions in science. And this is no exception. First of all, we found that unlike a lot of plants that make it to Hawaii, these plants actually were able to disperse off of Hawaii. And so once it got to Hawaii, it just was a single dispersal and arrival. And then from there, however, one lineage of the Hawaiian plants, we're not entirely sure which one, then migrated south, dispersed across the ocean down to the Marquesas and the Society Islands. And so that's a bit unusual. And then the most surprising find is one that we're not playing up yet to the extent it might be, because we're a little hesitant. You know, what could have gone wrong to get this result? But we got actually another dispersal, a back dispersal to the mainland. So the back dispersal to mainland was, he found a genetic signal of the Hawaiian group in Western North America. Now it's not super strong, so that's why we're a little hesitant. But that's what I would love to, or see somebody else take our study and run with that aspect of the study and see if it really, if it's true, that's one of the very rare instances where Hawaiian group made it back to the mainland.
Yeah, so it adds a really interesting question mark or wrinkle into this whole basically journey. I always love to ask, what should listeners think about the next time they're on a trail and they see the blueberry and they know that it's, you know, native and not introduced, but how should this deepen their appreciation for our native species?
It just provides a sense of place. This is endemic, only occurs on the Hawaiian Islands. It occurs on most of the islands, and you can find them. You have to go up into the mountains normally to see them because that's where they thrive. But the fact that you are seeing something that occurs only there and no place else, you are in a special place. The one thing I may want to add too, there might be a really good reason why they're in Hawaii today is because the habitat was right in those mountains. That's the one thing that if the habitat weren't there, even if the birds came to Hawaii, they might not have thrived in Hawaii. They might have died out very early because the habitats are in the montane areas, as they are temperate-like. They're cooler and obviously rainier, and so the soils are acidic, and blueberries just love acidic soil. So if those habitats weren't there, they might not be there today. And that's probably true of a lot of the temperate origin stories of Hawaii, like the silver swords and shidias and things like that that you might have heard of. There is one other thing as well. I think we're currently underestimating the number of species of these ohelos in Hawaii. Right now, there's really only three that are recognized, and that's caused all sorts of trouble for land managers and people who see these plants and try to identify them, and they're identifying them to different things based on which island they're from, and it's all been confusing. Our study is showing that species diversity is much higher.
Wow.
And we have a follow-up study that's in the works right now, and hopefully will be published within the year. We're actually looking at this focused on kind of the origin story. We're actually looking at populations within the islands and among the islands, and there's a lot of things to talk about, but that will provide a lot of information for land stewards and hopefully provide a lot of information for conservation of ohelo.
That was Peter Fritsch of the Botanical Research Institute at Texas, and the conversation's Maddie Bender. We will have links to the study on our website later today. That's it for us today. We're out of time. Tomorrow, we plan to check in with Governor Josh Green about his latest trip, but he was over at the Western Governors Conference. Got questions for him? Call our talkback line this afternoon, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.